Ads heard during the podcast that are not in my voice are placed by third-party agencies outside of my control and should not imply an endorsement by Weird Darkness or myself.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
The winter in Washington is a horrid time. The screams of the dead were almost wafting through the air. The wind, a cold and awful gust. It's been less than forgiving in my small little shelter I've holed up in. Fortunately, this derelict radio shack had all the necessary materials for what I require. My name is Eric. I'm a college student. Well, at least I was. 5 weeks ago, in an event nobody can explain, the dead came to life. Nobody expected an actual zombie apocalypse to happen. Until now, it was all science fiction. Whether it was through an experiment failed or something else, no one could be certain. What people really are certain of are the millions killed. I was in my college campus cafe, having a coffee, when I heard the television interrupted by an emergency broadcast. The news lady seemed really worried as she was on the scene. I only partly paid attention, but what really caught me was when she screamed. Everybody in the cafe looked at the screen in horror. A zombie had just struck down the news lady. The people in the cafe stood there in silence, as the screen read, "Please stand by." I did no such thing. Or at least I think I didn't. My memory is hazy. Ever since this whole thing began, I've been more scatterbrained. All I remember was that I ran. I ran straight to my car. It was almost like I couldn't control myself. I got a lot of food somewhere. Lots of it. I don't even recall where. Then the phantom drive I was experiencing told me to hide in the woods. Since then, I've holed up in the woods. I've had a few experiences with living in the outdoors, and I had enough food with me to last me a while. I had a car, I had a lot of gas, I had a tent, I had a fire. That's all a person really needed, right? To survive, sure. To stay sane, that's debatable. I feared going back. What if they all died? And I was next? This was out of every single zombie movie I'd ever seen. But I had never seen one guy go out by himself and live. By the laws of every zombie story ever told, I was supposed to be dead. Nobody is supposed to survive. That's why they call it an apocalypse. Nearly every bone in my body didn't want to believe it, but I eventually came to the realization everybody was probably dead. There would be no one to greet me if I returned. That's when the psychotic loneliness kicked in. It really hit home at about a week in. You know that saying, "You don't know what you got till it's gone"? I began to realize the true meaning of that phrase. I became desperate for human interaction. Anything. I almost decided to make a face in a tree, just to talk to something, like the movie Castaway. I didn't, though. I felt as though that would only make my psyche more vulnerable to panic. And I was not going to panic. I knew that if I was going to get through this, I would need to keep a level head. That's probably the reason why I decided to start writing. To calm my nerves, like it's always done. It helps me think straight. The first step to survival, at least in my mental set I had at the time, was to avoid the dead. Whatever was making them this way, it was contagious. Like in that game I played once, I think it was called Plague Inc. You made a disease that snuck in with simple means like touch and air, and then before you know it, your disease wipes out the entire planet. I wasn't going to let that happen to me. I felt as if that I could simply avoid blood contact, I'd be fine. I didn't see much in the wilderness. I was far, far out, but the more I thought about it, the more I feared it. Did a zombie know what they were doing? Did the person's consciousness still remain intact? No, they were dead. I felt sorry for them. Each and every one of them was a person. They had a future, a life. And now look, they're a bunch of sorry animals, slaves to a host. I could almost see it in their eyes. This is probably the main reason why I didn't kill any of them. I just avoided them. It's a lot harder to kill something if you look at its face. I'm sure there's science to that somewhere. Skip ahead 3 weeks. I just ran out of food, and I'm beginning to feel hunger pains for the first time in my life. As a pampered city boy, I had all the food I could eat, never had a care in the world. The times I did go camping, we always had enough food to last a week, even if we were going for just one night. My life at home was cozy as a heated blanket. All I had to do for work was college. I was going to get a degree in electronics and physics, maybe become an engineer. I've become a completely different person than I was then. I became someone desperate for interaction. Anything. I even started to call the voicemail service on my phone, simply hearing a person's voice through a recording. Not real, that soothed my nerves. The day finally came, though, when the phantom voice in my head told me that it was time to head back to the dreaded city. So many ill thoughts had preceded this day. But I knew I had to keep a positive outlook, even if I was more afraid than I was when the whole thing started. As I drove forward, I began to see them. They grew in number as I got closer. They got in groups, and I even avoided hitting one. The face science thing really comes into effect when you're only passing by. Most of them didn't even follow me. As if they could, they were as slow as a blind turtle. Or at least they seemed to be. When I finally reached the city, I rolled down the window. The smell of rotting corpses filled my lungs, making me gag. The city was almost in ruin. Windows were smashed, cars turned over. The dead were wandering, feeding on each other, even. I could fit through in my car through most of the wreckage. My truck was versatile enough. But the fact that I was safe still did not stop the horror I was exposed to. Those visions still keep me awake at night now. After an hour of seeing all of this, my psyche was in a fragile state. I couldn't find almost any food. I had no cell service. It seemed as though the cell towers were obviously down with the electricity. The worst part? All my paranoid nightmares came true. Not a single survivor. The biggest feeling of dread swept over me as I slowly put my head on the top of my steering wheel. I was alone. My mom was probably dead. My friends were probably zombies, mindless and decomposing. And there wasn't anything I could do but to die with them. I picked myself up after a couple of minutes. After getting my head together, I surmised that I couldn't let myself believe that I was alone, that would only mean defeat. There had to be survivors out there somewhere. I just need to communicate with them. That word, communicate, that was my drive. I had to find out if there were any survivors. Surely there could be others like me who went off and survived for this long. I had an old wind-up radio in my back seat. If I used my cards right, I could use it for finding others. I could broadcast to the world the FM and AM radio to see if people were still out there. I felt as though all of my worries fled as I saw what I describe as a holy shrine, a radio shack, the perfect place for me to find the materials to make just what I needed. I was going to find someone, even if it meant I would have to travel across the entire continent. Even if I have to spend the rest of my life looking, I will find someone. It's been about a week and a half. I don't know. I need to keep track of time better. Since I'd returned to the city, life has been twice as dangerous as it had been. The decaying corpses roam in groups now, sometimes feeding on the more whole of them without warning. They're getting hungrier, I believe. Whatever's controlling them, it's gaining intelligence. I even think I saw one of them run. This awful disease, whatever it really was, needed to be avoided at all costs. With the winter in full swing, things have begun to slow down. I work at a slower, more lethargic pace. As temperatures decrease, so does the number of the dead walking around, though. Fewer and fewer zombies seem to pass by my little hole in the ground that I call home. Of course, the sickening moan they always bring always makes me hesitate in my work. I keep checking and rechecking my back because I never know when one's just going to walk up to me. I ran into one once. I was out getting food when it saw me. It started walking over to me at a pathetic pace. Despite this, I bolted away. The paranoia is a tense emotion to deal with, especially when you're alone, left to your own thoughts. Those thoughts can be destructive to your mental state. I had plenty of food with me. That didn't stop me from rationing it. If I was in there for the long haul, I had to keep myself from becoming a slob. Of the minimal things I had learned with 2 months of being a Boy Scout, the one thing that stuck out the most was keeping self-control when lost. Right then, I was probably more lost than anyone else on this planet. More lost than my father when we go on little outings. My father. My family. My past. Seemed like years, when it's only been about 2 months? I keep thinking about my family. I loved them. A lot. I lost my aunt once, a long time ago. I was sad then, but now I've lost my entire family. Shouldn't I be feeling more remorseful? Sullen, even? I've not even had the slightest feeling of sadness ever since this happened. I remember in a psych class I took once, we learned about the 7 stages of grief, or was it 5 stages? I don't know. But I remember the first stage being shock. That was probably what I was experiencing. Shock is a feeling of numbness after an extreme change. I wasn't feeling any emotion, so I decided that it was better to stay that way for as long as possible. No emotion meant no distractions. That meant I could get my work done faster and contact somebody. That was the goal, to find someone. It didn't even have to be a girl, I just wanted to talk to anyone. I'm sure they're feeling the same way too. And I have a duty to find and protect anyone I came across. There are probably few people left, and I got to find them. At least, that's what the invisible feeling in my head was saying. Who am I to question something that comes from my mind? After another day of working on the radio and collecting more food, avoiding zombies, and generally not killing myself, I trudged myself into my boarded-up room in the radio shack. I slumped down in my chair and took a heavy sigh. I dared not look at the calendar. I already knew what day it was. Christmas Eve. Usually a day of happiness and joy. Today was the day that the magical man known only as Santa would have come down and given all the little kids the presents that they'd wanted so desperately. Of course, to this sad little man holed up in a broken-down building, struggling for warmth and surrounded by the deceased, the magic this Christmas seemed just a little bit sparse. What presents would be delivered today? Would sugar plums and cherries in dreams be replaced by the flesh of the living? Would every little zombie child receive a brain under their dead and bare Christmas tree? This Christmas just seemed to be a really screwed-up version of the Nightmare Before Christmas. Except this time, the world was giving the gift of the unliving curse. And I was the one responsible of watching the whole hellish thing. I was never really religious. I used to go to church, but then my family moved to a different area when I was little. We just stopped going. I was Catholic, I think. Never actually thought about a god, especially during a time like this. But after all these horrid events, after the probable massacre of the world, it was hard to believe there was a guy up there thinking, oh, I'll just let this happen. I remember times when things were so much simpler. Again, they feel so long ago. When it was only, what, last year? When I was sitting at my old house with my family? My younger brother, still in high school, was on his phone, almost seeming like he was ignoring us. My parents were near the campfire, most likely talking about how happy they were that I had come to visit. I remember getting an alarm clock in the shape of a companion cube from Portal, my favorite older game. I also got a t-shirt with some witty joke that I can't remember now. We were a simple family. One could almost say normal. In fact, we were normal. We were so normal it was abnormal how normal we were. My dad was a businessman who worked at a cubicle. My mom stayed at home, took care of us when we were young. The only thing that I had that was different was, well, the time I spent on video games and the internet. And even 2 years ago, that was completely a normal thing for a 19-year-old to be doing. The economy had been stabilized after 10 years, and everything was perfect in the world. Compared to now, as I hide in a broken-down business building struggling to survive. No fire. No, that would attract the dead. The lowest point in life sank onto me at that moment. I was almost in complete doubt that I would ever find anyone. Ever. The next morning was Christmas Day. I awoke, glad that I hadn't been eaten overnight. I was cold, though, so I put on a parka that I'd found in a nearby clothing shop. Today was the day, though, as I'd finally made the radio work. I'd hooked it up to a microphone. I went up to the mic, eager for my own Christmas present to myself. I flipped on the radio and static popped in my ears. I'd set it up as an interrupt, and a real powerful one, too. I'd set it so that if anybody had a radio on the West Coast, they would hear my voice. As a precaution, I'd set it so that I could receive signals, too, just in case anyone answered. I highly doubted that would happen, though. I turned on the mic, with my first and only word being a sheepish, "Hello?" I waited a second, deciding that I was too quiet, and I tried again. "Hello? Is anyone out there? Can anyone hear me?" I waited for a full minute. Then suddenly the static warped. I was paralyzed with excitement. Without warning, I was greeted with beeping. I didn't understand what it was, but it made my spirits as high as a kite flying in the wind. I then realized that I was listening to Morse code. The same four patterns kept beeping. Quickly, I wrote them down just as the beeping stopped suddenly. I quickly looked around for one of the survival books that I had scavenged containing a full Morse code translation list. The letters translated to FCAS. At first, I was confused. I mean, wouldn't it say help? FCAS? After careful consideration, I decided to rearrange the letters. I wasn't given gibberish. I was given a location. CA was for California, and the S and the F together made San Francisco. It was a stretch. I couldn't be sure that's what the message meant, but it gave me all the hope in the world. There was someone, maybe some people, calling for help. It'd be maybe a week and a half trip by car, nonetheless, but I knew in my heart that it was the right thing to do. It didn't matter who it was, as long as there was a who. Welcome, Weirdos! I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, the strange and bizarre, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. Coming up in this episode, we heard quite a bit about supply shortages during the COVID pandemic in the early 2020s, but how bad could it have gotten? Really? I mean, we're not talking famine, right? We never would have gone out into the streets armed to the teeth to steal food from others. That'd be un-American, not to mention being downright cruel and inhuman. Right? Well, tell that to the people of Richmond, Virginia in 1863, who rioted when the final straw for them was the price of bread going too high. After numerous twists and turns to get into position, the fighter pilot shot a total of 64 30mm shells at an extraterrestrial spacecraft to bring it down or destroy it altogether. Most all of his shots were direct hits, but his target continued on without a scratch. What happened at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant will forever be burned into the hearts and minds of scientists and historians worldwide. Two people died instantly from the explosion, dozens more from radiation poisoning in the months to come. But not everyone's buying the story that we've been told. They believe something more sinister took place and that it's being covered up. In February 2008, a contract murder took place, but there seemed to be no reason behind it. Who would want Lindsay Buzsiak dead? And why? But first, the one great thing about a zombie apocalypse, if one were to ever take place, is that we might finally be free from the stupidity of politicians. Or would we? We begin with that story. If you're new here, welcome to the show. While you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com for merchandise, my newsletter, to enter contests, to connect with me on social media. Plus, you can visit the Hope in the Darkness page if you're struggling with depression or dark thoughts. You can find all of that and more at WeirdDarkness.com. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and when we return from the break, we'll step into the Weird Darkness. My doc agrees that I need to lose a few pounds. I knew that going in. But he also told me that the meds I'm taking for my type 2 diabetes aren't going to do me much good if I finish each meal with ice cream or cheesecake. I kind of knew that in advance, too. But cutting back on carbs and sugars is a lot easier said than done. I've tried a lot of protein bars while on the road, but I swear it's like eating non-sweetened, chocolate-dusted particle board. But now I travel with Built Bars. Built Bars taste like candy bars. In fact, I'm now using them for my dessert. And at about 150 calories per bar, less than 3 grams of sugar, up to 19 grams of protein, I can satisfy my sweet cravings guilt-free. Visit WeirdDarkness.com/built and try a box. You can go for a variety pack of several flavors to try, or pick and choose to build a box of your own. Use the promo code WeirdDarkness at checkout and get 10% off your entire purchase. That's WeirdDarkness.com/built. Zombies, as a rule, are relatively apolitical. One brain is as good as another, gastronomically speaking. And while young flesh may be a little more tender and flavorful, it also tends to run faster. Having recently returned from the dead with cannibalistic hankerings and a lack of higher cognitive function, a zombie can't afford to ask your party affiliation before sinking its teeth in. Zombies are busy. Busy making more zombies and mindlessly shambling about the countryside, trapping survivors in indefensible positions. Lacking the capacity for strategic thinking, zombies may have to rely on the mathematics of epidemiology to further their cause. Epidemiology modeling of a zombie outbreak, it doesn't look good for humans. In 2009, a savvy group of Canadian mathematicians, obviously interested in existential risks to humanity, as well all should be, using basic biological assumptions derived from popular zombie movies, created a rudimentary mathematical model for zombie infections. examining the potential impacts of quarantines, cures, and an all-out zombie war on our future prospects. The answer was pretty straightforward. We all end up zombies or dead. The main problem is that the zombie population expands faster than the human survivors, no matter what we do. And those survivors, even if they are fruitful and multiply, they can't keep pace and are really just providing more grist for the ever-expanding zombie mill. The researchers concluded that the only marginally successful strategy would be impulsive eradication. That is, strategically and repeatedly destroying massive amounts of zombies as resources permit. Otherwise, we are pretty much doomed. An outbreak of zombies infecting humans is likely to be disastrous, unless extremely aggressive tactics are employed against the undead. While aggressive quarantine may eradicate the infection, it's unlikely to happen in practice. A cure would only result in some humans surviving the outbreak, although they'll still coexist with zombies. Only ever-increasing attacks with increasing force will result in eradication, assuming the available resources can be mustered in time. Furthermore, these results assumed that the timescale of the outbreak was short, so that the natural birth and death rates could be ignored. If the timescale of the outbreak increases, then the result is the doomsday scenario. An outbreak of zombies will result in the collapse of civilization, with every human infected or dead. This is because human births and deaths will provide the undead with a limitless supply of new bodies to infect, resurrect, and convert. Thus, if zombies arrive, we must act quickly and decisively to eradicate them before they eradicate us. We're not particularly good at acting quickly and decisively, or marshaling our resources cooperatively these days. So if our collective response to the COVID-19 epidemic is any indication, we should all get used to the taste of brains, given the outbreak of a zombie plague. One of the mathematical models disturbingly predicts that without coordinated response, in a city of 500,000 people, zombies will outnumber the uninfected within 3 days. Another study suggested that we would be completely overrun worldwide within 100 days. Fingers crossed that a zombie war largely remains the province of popular fiction. In fact, that is not the most disturbing thing about the work of these foresighted mathematicians for our day-to-day lives. A truly frightening and seemingly off-handed observation made by the researchers was, "Clearly, this is an unlikely scenario if taken literally, but possibly real-life applications may include allegiance to political parties and the spread of political views." Now, why would they go and say that? Well, epidemiological models generally assume that once you're dead, you stay dead. The problem with the zombie apocalypse in relation to other infectious diseases is that the dead can come back to life and continue to infect others. Extrapolate this to the world of political ideology, and you might come to some troubling conclusions. Nobel laureate Paul Krugman defined zombie ideas as things that people believe in the political sphere that are demonstrably false. They never die. They continue to propagate. Seems a little bit like the world we're living in right now, doesn't it? And people on both sides of the aisle could probably say that. People by and large can be pretty decent and reasonable on an individual basis, or so I'm told. Get them together in groups and you start having a problem. In the ordinary sense, the word crowd means a gathering of individuals of whatever nationality, profession, or sex, and whatever be the chances that have brought them together. From the psychological point of view, the expression crowd assumes quite a different signification. Under certain given circumstances, and only under those circumstances, an agglomeration of men presents new characteristics very different from those of the individuals composing it. The sentiments and ideas of all the persons in the gathering take one and the same direction, and their conscious personality vanishes. Le Bon, 1982, page 23. Of course, Le Bon was writing about crowd psychology between World War I and World War II, where if you wanted to form a mob, you did it in the streets. But in our modern information-saturated environment, we propagate our ideas through unfiltered social media. Our crowds are digital crowds, and our zombies are thought contagions, or in popular parlance, memes, derived from Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, That's ideas that have within themselves the means for their own self-propagation. That is, raise a bunch of kids who are taught that they should have lots of children. They'll have a bunch of children who believe that you should have a bunch of children. And the number of people believing you should always have tons of children steadily increases from generation to generation, and so on, until those that hold this belief far outnumber those who don't. Nazi propagandists worked under the assumption that if you tell a big enough lie, and tell it often enough, people will come to believe the lie. This idea is attributed to Joseph Goebbels, although nobody can find where he actually said it, except for related snarky comments from the British. They lived in a world where the spread of information was dominated by governments, broadcasters, and publishers, and probably would have had a hard time envisioning a world where the primary sources of information dissemination were informal, ubiquitous, and on a tribal rather than societal scale. Small ideas are circulated, amplified, repeated, and persist for long periods of time. In a more centralized model of information transmission, ideas, right or wrong, emerge. They're credited or discredited, and either become canon or die an inglorious death outside rarefied pockets of society, much like an infectious disease. In the data-infused world of today, ideas, memes, and ideologies emerge, spread rapidly throughout the infosphere, and are extremely hard to kill, often rising from the dead to once again spread perniciously. Much like a zombie epidemic. Millions of people can come to steadfastly believe blatant untruths, as those untruths serve to explain broken systems, fractured social relations, economic woes, and all the inadequacies of life. There is no cure. There is no quarantine. And ultimately, the beliefs become pervasive as the zombie ideas propagate faster than they can be eradicated, frequently rising from well-deserved graves to once again spread amongst us, giving a rather sinister cast to going viral. Perhaps zombification is inherent and inevitable in the formation of cultural norms, and civil society is continually in the process of rising, dying, and rising again. For as Alan Moore said, "Culture is just a shambling zombie that repeats what it did in life. Bits of it drop off, and it doesn't appear to notice." If the epidemiology of zombie ideas is anything like the mathematical models of a zombie plague, we're forced to ask a singularly important question. What wine pairs well with brains? During the Civil War, lack of food, money, and supplies created unbearable conditions for women living in the southern United States. Inflation and the lack of supplies left families reeling. Women especially felt the financial pinch and had difficulty providing food for their families. The situation was further exacerbated when the drought of 1862 impacted the harvest. Meager food supplies became even scarcer. The salt needed for preserving meat was also hard to come by. It was imported from the north and generally unavailable or too expensive to purchase. Tensions reached a boiling point in the spring of 1863 when civil unrest broke out in cities across the South. The unrest was organized by women, enraged by the exorbitant price of bread. They attacked stores and warehouses, stealing food, clothing, and supplies. The largest of these riots took place in Richmond, Virginia on April 2, 1863. In March 1863, a Richmond woman named Mary Jackson began recruiting women to participate in an organized protest. She was the mother of a Confederate soldier and frustrated with the government's inability to provide aid for her and other women whose men were away fighting. She garnered the support of about 300 women. On the morning of April 2, 1863, Jackson arrived at the market in Richmond. She was a peddler, but that day she brought nothing to sell. Instead, she increased recruitment efforts and began warning men that trouble was brewing. The growing crowd of women began marching towards the governor's office in Capitol Square, where they were turned away. There are varying reports of what happened next, with some claiming the governor eventually came and met with the women. The angry crowd began marching towards 9th Street. As the women marched, hundreds began to follow, and the crowd ballooned. Armed with guns, hatchets, and household implements, the women began to chant, "Bread or blood! Bread or blood!" They attacked grocery stores, warehouses, and other businesses, stealing food, supplies, even fine jewelry. Soon, Richmond Mayor Joseph Mayo arrived and read the riot act aloud to the mob. They ignored him. Governor John L. Letcher sent for Confederate President Jefferson Davis. He begged the women to disperse, warning that an artillery unit would open fire on the mob. Davis then emptied his pockets, throwing his money to the women. Tensions finally eased, and the crowd dispersed. Confederate Secretary of War James A. Seddon asked the local press to refrain from publishing news of the incident, fearing it would fuel Union propaganda. Confederate deserters, along with Union prisoners who watched the scene unfold from their cell windows, leaked the story. The New York Times published a front-page account of the riot on April 8th. Following the riot, more than 80 demonstrators were arrested, including Jackson. The women received varying degrees of punishment. Jackson's punishment was merely nominal. The city of Richmond increased efforts to provide aid to the poor, restoring a measure of calm. The 1863 bread riots showed just how difficult life had become for women on the home front. Coming up next, after numerous twists and turns to get into position, the fighter pilot shot a total of 64 30mm shells at an extraterrestrial spacecraft to bring it down or destroy it altogether. Most all of his shots were direct hits, but his target continued on without a scratch. Plus, in February 2008, a contract murder took place, but there seemed to be no reason behind it. Who would want Lindsay Buziak dead, and why? These stories and more when Weird Darkness returns. Remember staying up late at night while growing up, watching your local TV station's horror host presenting a terrible B-horror movie or so-bad-it's-good sci-fi flick from the 1950s? That's what the Monster Channel at WeirdDarkness.tv has to offer, all day, every day. You can visit WeirdDarkness.tv and immediately be entertained by a horror host and horrible movie. You can even invite your friends to watch with you and use the chat feature to talk about what you're watching. And our monthly Weirdo Watch Party takes place there as well. Get your frights and funnies 24/7, 365 at WeirdDarkness.tv. An Su-22 fighter pilot of the Peruvian Air Force experienced a real Independence Day in real life when he fired 64 30mm shells at a UFO to destroy it, but they had no effect on the UFO. In 1980, fighter pilot Oscar Santa Maria Huerta attempted to shoot down a mysterious light bulb-shaped UFO, which still remains the only documented case of a military plane shooting at a UFO. It was the early morning of April 11th, and a 23-year-old lieutenant in the Peruvian Air Force was preparing for daily drills along with about 1,800 military and civilian personnel at La Jolla Air Force Base, located 1,000 kilometers south of the Peruvian capital. Lieutenant Huerta, a pilot of 8 years' experience, was ordered to take off in his Russian-made Sukhoi 22 fighter jet to intercept a strange silver object that was hovering near the end of the runway. The object was 5 kilometers away, hovering about 600 meters off the ground and not responding to any messages. This balloon was in restricted airspace without authorization, posing a serious challenge to national sovereignty, the now-retired colonel writes in his book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Testify. Colonel Huerta was one of the many researchers, former officers, and others who testified at a major press event at the National Press Club in Washington in 2013 aimed at getting the U.S. government to open its files on UFO sightings. After taking off, Colonel Huerta climbed to an altitude of 2,500 meters and attacked the UFO. "I reached the required distance and fired a volley of 64 30mm shells, which created a cone-shaped wall of fire that normally destroyed everything in its path, he wrote. Just one of those shells would have destroyed a car, but they had no effect on the object. I thought then that the balloon would burst and gases would begin to flow out of it, but nothing happened. It seemed the shells were absorbed by the balloon, and it did not receive any damage. The object then shot skyward rapidly from the base, causing Colonel Huerta to activate the afterburner and begin a 500-meter chase behind it. When they reached the town of Camana, 84 kilometers from the base, the object suddenly stopped, causing him to veer sideways. Turning right and upward, Colonel Huerta attempted to position himself for another shot. "I began to approach him until he was in my sight," he writes. "I fixed the target and was ready to fire. But just at that moment, the object made another swift ascent, dodging the attack. I stayed under him. He thwarted the attack." He tried to repeat the same maneuver two more times, and each time the object evaded him, flying up several seconds before he could fire. By this time, the object was 14,000 meters above the ground. Colonel Huerta decided to attack the object from above so that it could not leave the kill zone. But the object pursued him at 19,200 meters, well beyond the performance of his aircraft. As he was running out of fuel, he realized he could not continue the attack and decided to fly closer to the object to get a better look at it. Only when it was 100 meters away did he realize what it was. "I was amazed to see that the balloon was not a balloon at all. It was an object about 10 meters in diameter, with a shiny, cream-colored dome on top, similar to a light bulb cut in half," he wrote. "Underneath was a wider, round, silver-colored base that looked like some kind of metal. It was missing all the typical airplane components. It had no wings, no jet engines, no exhaust pipes, no windows, no antennas, and so on. No visible propulsion system. At that moment, I realized it wasn't a spy device, but a UFO, something completely unknown. I was almost out of fuel, so I could neither attack nor maneuver my plane, nor make a high-speed maneuver. Suddenly, fear overwhelmed me. I thought I was finished." Colonel Huerta was able to make it to the airfield, burning the last remaining fuel and zigzagging to make the plane harder to shoot down, constantly watching the rearview mirrors, hoping that it wouldn't follow him. After landing, the object remained where he left it for another 2 hours, visible to everyone at the base as it reflected the sunlight. Colonel Huerta claims the object was seen by everyone on the base, many of whom had to report back. A June 1980 U.S. Department of Defense document entitled UFO Sighting in Peru describes the incident, but says only that the object is of unknown origin. A similar incident occurred in 1976 when Iranian Air Force General Parviz Jafari attempted to fire at a UFO, but found the equipment malfunctioned. As it turned out later, the armament was fine, but the UFO was able to disable it. "My equipment was mechanical, and that may have been the reason it could not be disabled, so instead the object had to bounce back at the last moment," Colonel Huerta writes. "I'm in a unique position, at least at this point, as far as I know, being the only military pilot in the world who has actually fired a weapon and hit a UFO. I still get goosebumps thinking about it." In February 2008, a young realtor named Lindsay Buziak met an unknown couple to see a house in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. And that was probably the place where she was killed, suddenly, unexpectedly, and as soon as she arrived. But strangely, for a murder committed in a residential area in broad daylight, that is about as much as we know. Lindsay's phone activity suggested that the entire crime was committed within just 3 minutes of her arrival at the house. Who killed her and why she was killed in such an organized and professional manner remains mysterious. But there is some evidence out there, and a picture of the events that day can be pieced together. The story that emerges is one of a carefully laid trap, with the murderers luring Lindsay Buziak to the house where she was about to be killed. Lindsay was 24 years old and a busy realtor. A few days earlier, she had received a call speaking to a woman with a Mexican or Spanish accent. The woman wanted to discuss relocating to Victoria following a job offer she had received there. The caller gave a list of amenities that she said that she and her husband were looking for. Lindsay circled the date, 1st of February, in her diary, and started to put together viewings for the caller. The caller was looking for a large property. She requested 3 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and separate housekeeper quarters. She was ready to pay $1 million for the house, but the catch for all of these requirements was that she needed it in just 3 days. But for whatever reason, Lindsay did not record the name of the caller. Lindsay named the client Million Dollar and referred to her as this in her diary and notes. Lindsay was also unsure of how this lady got her personal number. Documents which came to light in 2020 show that Lindsay tried to contact some of her existing clients to see if they knew of this strange caller, but no one was able to help her. Lindsay nevertheless decided to go ahead with the property viewings, sending a list of homes and some suggestions to the woman on the 1st of February the following day. Lindsay then gave an address to the woman to meet, 1702 DeSousa Palace. The property was large, situated in a cul-de-sac. The address was in the Victorian suburb of Saanich in the Gordon Head neighborhood. The meeting was then set to commence at 5:30 p.m. on February 2nd. On the day of the meeting, Lindsay left her office for a lunch date with Jason Zalo, her boyfriend, between 3 and 4 p.m. Jason and Lindsay left the restaurant after lunch at around 4:20, leaving Lindsay just over an hour to get to her meeting. Jason then returned to work, and Lindsay then went to change clothes before heading out for the viewing. Lindsay called Jason to inform him that she was leaving to meet the clients. Jason was concerned about her meeting with clients that she didn't know and asked to follow Lindsay for this property visit, to which she agreed. Once on his way, Jason found that he could not locate the property using his car's GPS system and so called Lindsay to ask for directions. He could hear the clients arrive during the call, with Lindsay confirming, "I'll see you in a bit, I gotta go. The Mexicans are here." Lindsay then hung up. 2 witnesses that day also saw the Mexican couple walking to the DeSousa property. Lindsay greeted the man and woman in the driveway and went into the property with them. The time was 5:29 p.m. Less than 10 minutes later, at 5:38 p.m., Jason texted Lindsay saying that he was just a few minutes away from the property. Lindsay never replied or answered that text, but at 5:41 p.m., a call was placed from Lindsay's phone to a friend. This was odd, as Lindsay had not been in touch with this friend for a long time and would not ordinarily make private calls when with clients. The voice call from the recording sounded a bit muffled, but was of no use to investigators. Jason, with a friend named Cohen, entered the street the property was on. They saw Lindsay's car in the driveway and then looked at the house, glimpsing a man through the front door window. They were unable to see his face and assumed he was the client Lindsay was with. Jason and Cohen then decided to sit in the car, waiting for around 10 minutes. Jason then turned around the car and parked it on the neighboring street, named Torque Drive. They again waited for around 10 minutes before Jason texted Lindsay to see if she was okay before phoning her. Lindsay never replied. Jason and Cohen then approached the property and found that the front door was locked, which they thought was unusual. Jason then called 911 to inform them about the situation. Jason and Cohen then entered the property from the back door to search for Lindsay. Jason found Lindsay's body in a pool of blood upstairs in the master bedroom. She had been stabbed 40 times before dying of blood loss, and nobody else was in the house. Jason asked Cohen to call 911 again and tried CPR on Lindsay, but it was too late to save her. And that is all that is known. Who the clients were, where they went, or why they killed Lindsay have never been answered. Lindsay did not seem to have any enemies, nor did she seem to expect any danger when she visited the property. There are other strange aspects to the case as well. If this was a contract killing, as suggested by the foreign accents, why was Lindsay stabbed 40 times? If a crime of passion, who were the killers? Witnesses provided the sketch of a woman whom they saw entering the house, and they also said that the man was 6 feet, white, and had dark hair. But no further details were available, and no progress into catching the suspects has been made. Lindsay had deleted her chat messages from her phone, which investigators thought was strange. There is hope that investigators using new technologies and working alongside the FBI may eventually find the answers that Lindsay's family needs through DNA analysis or other trace evidence. But for now, Lindsay Buziak was just a real estate agent killed without warning and for no known reason. Why did someone go to such lengths to have her killed? And where are her killers now? When Weird Darkness returns, what happened at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant will forever be burned into the hearts and minds of scientists and historians worldwide. Two people died instantly from the explosion, dozens from the radiation poisoning in the months to follow. But not everyone is buying the story that we've been told. They believe something more sinister took place and that it's all being covered up. That story is up next. No matter the time of day or season, sometimes you need to find a way to rid yourself of those ghostly chills that bring raised hairs and goosebumps to your skin. Other times, you're looking for those ghostly chills. Either way, it sounds like you need a mug of Weird Dark Roast Coffee. Weird Dark Roast Coffee has deep notes of cocoa, caramel, and a touch of sinister sweetness that'll send shivers down your taste buds. This is an exclusive coffee that I selected specifically for you, my weirdo family. Weird Dark Roast is not available in stores, coffee houses, mad scientists, labs, or even the dark web, but you can find it at WeirdDarkness.com/coffee. Weird Dark Roast Coffee, fresh roasted to order so it's as fresh as it can be when it lands on your doorstep and knocks three times. Grab yours now at WeirdDarkness.com/coffee. That's WeirdDarkness.com/coffee.
Weird Dark Roast Coffee does not actually knock on your door because it doesn't have arms or hands, so if you hear knocks at the door and no one answers when you ask who it is, it's probably paranormal and you should just leave the door shut and locked.
Many present the truth about Chernobyl as such. April 26, 1986, a nuclear reactor at Chernobyl erupted, instantly terminating two people. Over the next few months, dozens more people succumbed to the effects of acute radiation syndrome, or ARS. The world watched in horror as the city of Pripyat, then part of the USSR, now part of Ukraine, and surrounding villages fled permanently from the flood of radiation estimated to be more potent than the device dropped on Hiroshima. People didn't understand how a routine safety check could create such a catastrophe, and many were left wondering what really happened at Chernobyl. Collectively, over 150,000 people in the region were immediately affected by the world's most devastating unintentional nuclear incident, ranked evenly with Fukushima. That number is nowhere near the millions who have been affected by the trickle-down effects of radiation. Generations following the disaster have been plagued with various forms of genetic diseases and mutations. The government maintained the incident was the result of a flawed reactor design, coupled with human error, insinuating the workers weren't sufficiently trained to handle any sort of emergency situation. However, the truth about Chernobyl remains muddled with various conflicting conspiracy theories, spanning everywhere from CIA involvement to, of course, aliens. For over 30 years, the area remained largely abandoned, with any evidence of conspiracy being left to rust with time. Today, the eerie ruins are open to those who dare to brave the still questionable radiation levels. An amusement park sits untouched, schools stand empty and strange. Soviet radiation equipment rusts in the woods once raised by radiation. If the alleged ghosts of Chernobyl could speak, what would they have to say? Let's dive into the conspiracy theories of the devastating Chernobyl disaster. Starting in 1976 and carrying into the 80s, everyone with a radio began hearing an obnoxiously loud and alarmingly strong radio signal. The signal was strong enough to gather complaints from countries around the globe, and it was soon deduced the signal was coming from somewhere behind the Iron Curtain. Dubbed the Russian Woodpecker, the signal was assumed to be exceptionally forceful over-the-horizon technology, meaning its job was to look out for any missile heading for Russia. Unsurprisingly, given the Cold War, it was facing the US, though it continued to irritate the world over. Before the disaster at Chernobyl, the location of the military radio base was so classified it was marked as a children's summer camp on maps, However, the disaster left Duga 3 abandoned in the Exclusion Zone, the name of the nearly 12 square miles of fallout area surrounding the nuclear base. It's now a tourist and conspiracy theorist destination. However, theorists wonder if the base was really just another Soviet structure abandoned in the wake of the disaster, or if it was really the root of the tragedy itself. Some believe when the $7 billion project turned out to be a flop, perhaps because natural forces interfered with the radar, rendering it useless in terms of intercepting potential projectiles, high-up Soviet bureaucrats ordered the nuclear meltdown in order to save their own positions and power. The top-secret failure of a radio base was the main focus of Chad Gracia's 2015 documentary, The Russian Woodpecker. In the film, Ukrainian performance artist Fedor Alexandrovich wildly tries to get to the bottom of the Duga 3 conspiracy. He interviews all sorts of officials and personnel involved in the Chernobyl disaster and subsequent cleanup, mostly getting reactions of, "You're insane." The radio system itself at Duga 3 is a huge, insanely futuristic-looking setup of Soviet-era radio wires and antenna that jut into the sky like some great metal insect. Alexandrovich insists this specific structure is the real culprit behind the reactor 4 meltdown. However, there is some truth to his claims concerning the Russian Woodpecker cover-up conspiracy. The Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, affect satellite signals, and all the radio systems should be built taking this into consideration. He assumes Duga 3 was not built with the Northern Lights in mind. He also confirmed a decent amount of Soviet engineering lacked thorough planning and safety consideration. The test which caused the reactor to erupt was actually the second version of a safety experiment that had failed the previous year. The documentary also stresses the fact that the radio base cost nearly double that of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, a costly failure by any generation's standards. When the incident happened in 1986, Duga 3 was in the exclusion zone, meaning all military personnel there dropped whatever they were doing and evacuated along with everyone else. The huge, futuristic radio station was left unmanned. The bizarre thing is the obnoxiously recognizable ticking signal the station sent out continued to do so for 3 more years. Then, in 1989, it suddenly stopped. The signal itself had garnered all sorts of conspiracy theories back when it first started terrorizing the world's radio waves in 1976. At a frequency of 10 Hz, worried listeners claimed it was for everything from mind control to weather control, but nobody could pinpoint the location of the signal. Those who believe Chernobyl was a cover-up for Duga 3 like to point out the mysterious circumstances and highly classified shroud around the base. It was clearly important to the military, but was it important enough to cause the worst nuclear meltdown to date in order to protect whatever secret it was hiding? In 2013, radio users were surprised to hear again what was the undeniable tick of the Russian Woodpecker signal. Conspiracy theorists quickly got excited, but the signal was dismissed as contemporary Russian over-the-horizon technology, one that would hopefully work this time. So about that whole thing where the Russian Woodpecker radio signal could detect incoming projectiles, well, conspiracy theorists like to postulate the signal could also be used to guide and launch their own, which were stored underground. It reads like the plot of a Soviet spy movie, but a 2017 Science Channel special, Mysteries of the Abandoned, explores this theory. Theorists believe in an attempt to thwart the USSR's nuclear capabilities, the CIA sabotaged equipment at the Chernobyl nuclear plant, causing the malfunction that triggered the reactor to malfunction. The hour-long episode follows an American civil engineer and self-admitted Chernobyl researcher, Philip Grossman, as he pokes around the exclusion zone with what seems like an alarming amount of freedom. The area is still highly restricted due to obvious radiation hazards. Grossman's theory follows this conspiracy line, insinuating that there was a major, top-secret radio base close to the nuclear power plant. Civil engineer Philip Grossman outlines the CIA conspiracy theory further in the Science Channel's 2017 special about Chernobyl. In the episode, Grossman lays out the facts. All within a small vicinity, there is a nuclear power plant, a potential projectile launch base, and what was supposedly a normal goods factory. However, he suggests the factory was perhaps built as a shell to disguise an underground chemical laboratory. According to this theory, scientists built military devices combined with the plutonium from the nearby Chernobyl plant. This, he theorizes, all posed far too much a threat once the CIA connected the dots. In case the Cold War suddenly became hot, the theory suggests the CIA sabotaged the plant technology, leading to the absolute disaster that even the Soviet's last leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, admitted contributed significantly to the fall of the Soviet Union. This would all be a bit hard to swallow if it weren't for the CIA's established track record when it came to security measures, according to Grossman. Covert CIA operations during the conflict included parachuting soldiers into the Arctic to investigate an abandoned Soviet base, Project Cold Feet, dragging plutonium up the Himalayas to spy on China, Mount Everest was a no-go, but they tried, and borrowing a Soviet lunar spacecraft. Don't worry, they returned it. Stunts like these make conspiracy theorists wonder if the CIA wasn't truly behind the Chernobyl disaster. Another theory suggests the Chernobyl meltdown was in fact a planned move by the KGB. The disaster would ensure Western and Central European dependency on Russia for energy far down the road by instilling a European fear of nuclear power, and they would have to rely on Russia's vast supply of natural energy resources. If this were true, it would be difficult to deny the failure of the plan. In a 2003 Politico article, Rain F. Deer argues much of Europe remains too frightened by the Chernobyl incident to build any of their own plants. Nuclear power in Europe has become a divisive force, with Baltic countries such as Bulgaria being told they must shut down all nuclear plants in order to be admitted into the European Union. The article states by 2020, 75% of Europe would be dependent on Russia for oil and gas energy. Europe only has so much as far as these resources go, and large shifts towards nuclear power don't seem to be anywhere on the near horizon. No roundup of conspiracy theories would be complete without the obvious – extraterrestrial intervention. However, in this case, they're actually the good guys. This is more of a it-could-have-been-worse theory. A large number of people maintain the Chernobyl disaster could have been a global catastrophe, but a few UFOs zoomed in and saved the day. An eyewitness at the scene, Mikhail Voritsky, stated, "I and other people from my team went to the site of the blast at night. We saw a ball of fire, and it was slowly flying in the sky. I think the ball was 6 or 8 meters in diameter. Then we saw two rays of crimson light stretching towards the fourth unit. The object was some 300 meters from the reactor. The event lasted for about 3 minutes. The lights of the object went out and it flew away in the northwestern direction." Believers claim this UFO intervention during the blast saved the disaster from becoming a global nuclear event. 3 years later, in 1989, more reports of a UFO came in. This time, the UFO hovered over a newly smoking reactor, stopped the smoke, and sped off. Air traffic controllers in the area also reported seeing strange, unidentified flying crafts in the weeks preceding the meltdown. Far off the southern coast of Greece lies a tiny island called Gavdos. On the island is a commune started by a Russian scientist who survived an especially strong blast of radiation. The commune is composed of other Chernobyl survivors, along with highly esteemed Russian scientists who worked at the Russian equivalent of NASA. So what in the world are they doing on a speck of an island in the Mediterranean? Achieving immortality, apparently. The eccentric group of survivors and scientists has been working towards immortality, though the methods are shrouded in secrecy. When the survivors began building strange structures and performing secretive, esoteric experiments, native residents of the Greek island became suspicious. Some believe they are KGB spies or CIA operatives. European intelligence services even sent down agents for a proper investigation. However, despite all Chernobyl or KGB-linked theories, it appears the commune is harmless, albeit unusual. The Soviet government admittedly has a checkered track record when it comes to honesty, like the nuclear disaster of Kyshtym they covered up, or the fact they dumped radioactive materials into Lake Karachay for almost 40 years. Soviet officials even confessed in the LA Times they were conducting experiments in the plant at the time of the incident that led to the malfunction and subsequent destruction, but they did not specify what type of experiment they were conducting. There's a conspiracy theory, largely among Russians, interestingly enough, that the Chernobyl disaster was a planned genocide created to see the effects on humans of such a catastrophic nuclear event. During the stress and chaos of the Cold War, conspiracy theorists suggest that there was no feat too daring for the KGB to try, even if it meant terminating a large number of the population and producing diseased citizens for generations to come. And then there are the religious conspiracy believers. In the Book of Revelations, specifically Revelations 8 verses 10 through 11, it reads, "And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters, and the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men passed of the waters because they were made bitter." The Russian word for wormwood is Chernobyl. Religious conspiracy zealots liken the disaster to the angel having sounded the third trumpet, the eruption being the great star from heaven. They go on to describe the rain that followed the disaster and further spread the radiation as the waters made bitter. Additionally, the memorial for the first responders who were sent in to fight the fires, all of whom passed, is a statue of an angel blowing a trumpet. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. WeirdDarkness.com is also where you can find all of my social media, listen to free audiobooks I've narrated, visit the store for Weird Darkness t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, phone cases, and more merchandise. Sign up for monthly contests, find other podcasts that I host, and find the Hope in the Darkness page if you or someone you know is struggling with depression or dark thoughts. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, you can click on Tell Your Story. You can find all of that and more at WeirdDarkness.com. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Air-to-air combat with a flying saucer is from Earth Chronicles. The Politics of the Zombie Apocalypse is from Esoterics.com. The Richmond Bread Riot was written by Jenny Ashcraft for Fishwrap. Chernobyl Conspiracies is by Colleen Conroy for Graveyard Shift. Who Killed Lindsay Buziak is by Bipin Dimri for Historic Mysteries. And the fictional short story Apocalypse at the beginning of this episode was written by Regisatra. Weird Darkness is a production and trademark of Marler House Productions. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. 1 Peter 4 verse 8. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. And a final thought, enthusiasm about reaching your goals is the fuel that will empower you to take action. Zelig Pliskin. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.